Lieutenant Colonel Dan Ward of the United States Air Force is author of Fire, How Fast, Inexpensive, Restrained, and Elegant Methods Ignite Innovation. Colonel, thank you very much for being on the program with me today. Innovation is a word we hear over and over and over again. Frank Kendall talking about it extensively as he rolled out Better Buying Power 3.0, and it's an attempt by the Defense Department to increase the possibilities of success, the likelihood of success, and lower the cost of acquisitions at the Defense Department. I'd like you to start with a story from your book, please. Tell me about the Condor Cluster.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, thanks so much for having me on the show. I'm really excited to be here. The opening story in my book is about a supercomputer called the Condor Cluster. It was developed by the Air Force Research Lab in 2010. And when they cut the ribbon in December of that year, it was the fastest supercomputer in the entire Department of Defense. So it outperformed all the other high-speed machines that the Pentagon has access to. What was really interesting about that particular piece of hardware is that they built it for one-tenth the cost of a comparable supercomputer. And it uses one-tenth the electricity. So, you know, it's inexpensive to own, inexpensive to operate, has a smaller carbon footprint, all kinds of things to love about it. The thing I love most about it is that they made it out of 1,760 PlayStation 3s. That they cobbled together in a way that, like I said, outperformed every other supercomputer that the Pentagon has access to.
The Condor Cluster in your book is a contrast to a program that you point out, the A-12 Avenger. How is that the opposite of what you saw with the Condor Cluster?
Sure. So with the Condor Cluster, the objective was to be fast, inexpensive, and simple. So the team who was involved in developing that particular product really focused on speed, thrift, and simplicity. The A-12, the Navy's A-12 Avenger, is really the classic case study in defense acquisitions gone wrong, military technology gone wrong. A lot of money, a lot of years, and really no aircraft to show for it. The story I tell is that about 3 months prior to the Condor Cluster being delivered, the A-12 was in the Supreme Court trying to figure out whose fault it was that things had gone so badly. And the Supreme Court ended up sort of kicking that back down, and the long protracted legal battle continued. But the problem with the A-12 Avenger is that it really fit the model of a big, expensive, complicated program where we initially set out to spend a lot of time, spend a lot of money, build something that's really complicated. And what we ended up doing was basically having a program that cost more, took longer, and did a lot less than was promised.
You write in the book some of the key questions in the acquisition process, and people have been looking at these questions for many years. But you write in response to those questions, the pattern that emerged is this. The most successful project leaders from government and industry alike tend to deliver top-shelf stuff with a skeleton crew, a shoestring budget, and a cannonball schedule. In contrast, project leaders who are cursed with large budgets, large teams, and long schedules generally have a difficult time delivering even a fraction of the promised capability. That sounds like the exact opposite of how it should be. And yet, as you demonstrate in this book and as we've seen in the procurement world in government, it bears out to be true an overwhelming percentage of the time, Dan.
It really is. You know, these patterns keep popping up. And what's funny, sometimes people will read my book and say, you know, Dan, you're just talking about lean or agile, or what I'm talking about is common sense. Yes, of course, if you have a small team of talented people, give them a short schedule and a tight budget, that they're going to deliver good stuff. And I think there's a certain amount of common sense inherent in that. But at the same time, the conventional wisdom does say the best way to solve problems is to add time and money. And when we encounter a problem, hey, give me a little more time and money and I can fix this. A lot of the conventional wisdom says that complexity is a sign of sophistication. So the more complicated your thing is, whether it's your organization, your process, or your technology, obviously, that's the better of a job you must be doing because, hey, you have a very complicated thing. So, well, you know, I sort of push back on the idea that any of this is just plain old common sense, again, because that conventional wisdom places such a premium on large budgets, long timelines, and high levels of complexity, as well as the large organizations that go along with that.
Dan, the Fire Prime Directive made me smile. Number one, because I'm somewhat of a Star Trek geek. I didn't get any sense from your book, of course, that you are, except for the, 30 or 40 different Star Trek references throughout the book. At any rate, the Fire Prime Directive, tell me what that means and why that's so important in your view.
Sure. So there's a lot of science fiction references and pop culture references in the book. And that was one of the real fun things to do with this particular piece. And actually, going back a couple of years, one of my early sort of popular articles that I published was basically looking at technology lessons from Star Wars. And the basic message there was build droids, not Death Stars. I always felt a little bit bad that that was my most popular article because I'm much more of a Trekkie than a Star Wars fan, although, of course, I like both. So when I came time to write this book, I said, I've got to come up with some sort of Star Trek principle, some sort of Star Trek lesson in here. And I came up with the prime directive. Of course, in the Star Trek TV show and the movies, the prime directive basically says, don't interfere with the natural progression of civilizations that we encounter out in space. And I said, gosh, that's a pretty good idea. And when we apply that to technology, the idea is, don't unnecessarily insert advanced technologies into a project where they don't belong, where they're not needed. So we're trying to avoid excessive over-engineered features for the same reasons as Star Trek has their prime directive. Gosh, when you interfere with the development of a culture, it leads to all kinds of bad things. When we insert unnecessarily advanced technologies into our development projects, our weapon systems, our IT systems, it tends to reduce the effectiveness, increases the fragility, it makes maintenance harder, makes it heavier, makes it harder to fix, harder to use, leads to all sorts of, and more expensive, leads to all sorts of bad outcomes.
You write, the Fire Prime Directive is an expression of restraint and focus implemented for benevolent reasons and intended to benefit both the project's developers and the customers. I appreciate your injecting the concept of the customer there, because one thing I'm hearing from folks in DOD and in the civilian agencies more and more is the need to keep the customers, the end users, integrated in the process, not just at the beginning when you're setting requirements, but throughout development, especially as agile development becomes more popular.
Absolutely. That's so key. You know, we don't do acquisitions for the sake of the acquirers or the engineers or the contracting officers. We do it because we need to deliver some sort of meaningful capability to the people on the other end, the users. And it's all fine and good to involve them up front and early. And that's great. We definitely need to focus on that. But then we can't just walk away and leave them behind. They need to be a continuous presence, a continuous involvement, a continuous voice in the whole thing. And I'm a huge fan of Agile development. And a lot of the principles and practices I talk about in the book, both the ideas and the actions, have a lot of strong parallels with the Agile community.
Okay, and for every rule, every good rule can be broken, and you write that there is the Prime Directive was honored more in the breach than in the observance. What do you mean by that, and how does that apply to what we're talking about here, Dan?
Absolutely. You know, apparently, I went pretty far out of my way to reveal what a nerd and geek I am as I wrote this book.
But you did it tastefully.
Oh, I hope so. Thank you. And when you look at within the Star Trek universe, all the TV shows and movies and things, when they talk about the Prime Directive, oftentimes what they're doing is bending it a little bit, breaking it a little bit, and using it more as a guideline than a hard and fast rule. And so the same thing happens within technology. When we're talking about building advanced technologies, of course we're going to be inserting new high-tech features, functions, and capabilities into the things we build and deliver. So the idea isn't to avoid high tech entirely. I mean, I've got three engineering degrees myself, so I'm kind of into this whole high tech thing. But the idea is to exercise restraint, to not do it too much. And when we do experiment, when we do insert something that, you know, is maybe a little bit more advanced than maybe was necessary, to then reflect back on that experience and say, hey, was this a good idea? Did it work? What can we learn to apply on future projects?
Dan Ward is author of Fire, How Fast, Inexpensive, Restrained, and Elegant Methods Ignite Innovation. And this book has just made a list of recommended reading by the Office of Management and Budget. You can read there the comments of Leslie Field and Tom Khalil at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, along with finding a link to more information about Dan's book. A letter from Karachi jumped out at me in chapter 2 of your book as something that you found particularly instructive. Who sent it? Who did he send it to? And why did he send that letter, Dan?
Sure. So when I was at the Air Force Institute of Technology out in Wright-Patterson, I had a chance to do some research at the Air Force Museum. And one of the great experiences I had out there was to go into the the back of the vaults and get my hands on some pretty old documents about the early days of aviation. And I came across this letter from 1942. It was signed by Colonel Tex Sanders, who was commander of the Army Air Corps 51st Fighter Group. So he's there in Karachi, India. This is before Pakistan even existed as a country. And he's the commander of the 51st Fighter Group. And his letter is a request for these new aircraft that he's heard about. Some of his pilots have tested them, and he's just heard great things about them. It's the P-51 Mustang. Now, the P-51 Mustang is famous for a number of things, to include being developed on a very tight schedule and being very inexpensive. And what I loved about his letter is the things he complimented the P-51 for, the attributes of the P-51 that he complimented. He said, you know, certainly it outmaneuvers the P-41, the P-40, the P-38, all the other aircraft that were comparable to it. He said it's great even at high speeds of 500 miles per hour and handles altitude well up to 15,000 feet. And he said the pilots who have tested it loved it and have been preaching it ever since. But what I really liked was the line that this aircraft in no way exhibits any previously unknown features. So he was saying, hey, we can maintain it with our current tools. It's compatible with our current radios. It's inexpensive, and we can get access to it now. So please send me some of these P-51 Mustangs. The P-51 went on to, if I recall the numbers, fly 200 plus missions during World War II. And you know, we bought tens of thousands of them. So the premier aircraft of its age was described as a very simple, very modest, but very high performance aircraft. And you know, when we talk about it didn't exhibit any previously unknown engineering features, that sort of description would oftentimes be considered a criticism today if we were to apply that to, you know, a modern aircraft. But he said it, meaning it as a compliment. And you know, that matters a lot. The guy who will actually be flying it wants something that's dependable, highly effective. And he really valued simplicity, speed, and thrift.
Your book says the United States military bought 14,819 Mustangs that flew 213,800 combat missions during World War II. And after the war ended, the Mustang remained in service for 35 years. I'm reminded of a statement by somebody who doesn't have anything to do with any of the worlds that we're talking about, Dan. But just the idea of improving something that exists already. This guy is an entrepreneur and talking about building entrepreneurial businesses, and he continually advocates that you don't have to think up an entirely brand new idea. You just have to do something somebody else is already doing 10% better than anybody else, and you can be tremendously successful. And that concept really struck me as I was reading this chapter of your book. That seems to be the same idea that you're getting at.
Absolutely. And the number I've heard is that the P-51, the first prototype, was built in about 117 days. And some people will push back and say, no, it really was 3 or 4 months longer than that. But even if you add 3 or 4 months to that 117 days, it's still awfully fast. And one of the reasons they were able to go that fast is that they tapped into some existing designs, some work that had been done previously, some existing engines, and they put together these existing parts in a new and interesting way so that the final product was greater than the sum of its parts.
You note that Colonel Sanders' eye for aircraft served him well. His story ended pretty good, didn't it?
It did. It did. He went on to become a general and retired after many years of service, and I believe lived to be 95 or 98, if I recall.
Was in his upper 90s and became commander of the Allied Air Forces in Northern Europe in 1954. Dan Ward is my guest. His book is called Fire, How Fast, Inexpensive, Restrained, and Elegant Methods Ignite Innovation. You refer in your book to a concept called TRIZ, T-R-I-Z. What is TRIZ, Dan? Where did it come from?
Sure. So TRIZ is actually a Russian acronym. And the English words are the theory of inventive problem solving. It's an approach to problem solving and to technical innovation that was developed by a guy named Genrich Altshuler. Altshuler was thrown into the gulag by Stalin when he was living in Russia. And while he was there with a bunch of other intellectuals, he just basically spent his time learning anything anyone would teach him. When he finally was released, and he did survive his time in the gulag, when he was released, he came up with this theory of inventive problem solving. And there's a number of different tools and techniques that TRIZ includes in their overall method. And one of the more common ones is to, when you're facing an unsolved technical problem, You take that specific problem and you restructure it, you reform it into a general problem statement. And then you consult this little matrix that they have, and they find general solutions that go along with that general type of problem. Then all you need to do is take that general solution and translate it into a specific solution. And I go through some diagrams in the book that talk about that. But one of the things I really tried to do with the book was include not just ideas, but also actions. So principles as well as practices, theory as well as actual tools, techniques, and things you can do. And trees is one of the practices I point to. Very powerful set of tools and a lot of really fantastic free material online for anybody who wants to learn about trees.
We can put some links to that material at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. You write in chapter 4 of this book, Dan, that NASA had a bad year in 1999. Mars climate orbiter missed Mars entirely. The Mars polar lander went silent before it even landed. Some big problems there for a theory that they called the faster, better, cheaper concept, FBC. They've been using it since 1992. But you go on to detail how that was kind of misleading. The failures in 1999 were kind of misleading. Take us back to the beginning when they started to use this and explain why 1999 was misleading for NASA and what it means.
Yeah, faster, better, cheaper is one of my favorite data sets to look at. And again, as an engineer, I like to look at the data, do the math, and follow the data and see where they lead. And from 1992 to 1999, NASA launched 16 missions under this umbrella that they called Faster, Better, Cheaper. And these weren't just minor, you know, little toy projects. These were some of the biggest, hardest, hairiest scientific exploration missions that NASA has ever done, to include a trip to Mars, one to the moon, 4 satellites, and even an asteroid rendezvous. Now, for the first 7 years, from 1992 until 1999, 9 of the first 10 missions succeeded wildly. Now, Dan Golden, who was the administrator at the time, had said, look, if we have a 100% success rate, then we've done something wrong. We haven't pushed the envelope far enough. So I think even that 90% success rate was a higher success rate than anybody at NASA ever envisioned. And some of these missions included the Near-Earth Asteroid Rendezvous Project, which was a 2 billion mile trip to intercept an asteroid, which is the first time any such mission had been attempted. It collected 10 times more data than was expected at less than 2/3 of the original cost estimate. And even though they didn't design it to be a lander, they landed it on the asteroid so gently, it was about 2 meters per second, so gently that they continued to transmit data for another 2 weeks. So huge, huge success ahead of schedule. And again, they had $88 million left over in their budget. They were $88 million under budget.
And so, that's okay. Out of a budget of only $200 million. So that's not small change.
Absolutely, absolutely. So really about 2/3 of the original cost estimate, pretty impressive achievement. Now in 1999, though, 4 out of 5 missions failed under this faster, better, cheaper umbrella. And as an engineer, when you see clustered failures like that, the conclusion is, well, something must have gone wrong in that year, or something must have gone wrong later in the cycle of these missions. Unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, the consensus ended up being that there was something fundamentally flawed with faster, better, cheaper, and it must not work. And so NASA moved away from that. But my contention in the book is that they kind of did the wrong math, because the total cost for all 16 faster, better, cheaper missions, the total cost was less than what we've spent on the Cassini mission to Saturn. Now, Cassini is a huge success. I'm an enormous fan of Cassini. They're doing brilliant science and really producing some amazing artwork even with the photos of Saturn. But for the same money we spent on that, NASA also did these 16 other missions, of which only 10 succeeded. But gosh, 10 successes for the price of one is a pretty good deal.
You write about 5 unconventional secrets that NASA learned through the faster, better, cheaper process. And I'd like to review each of them in turn. The first one is do it wrong. Talk about counterintuitive.
Absolutely. So Dr. Alexander Loffer and Ed Hoffman wrote a report called 99 Rules for Managing Faster, Better, Cheaper Projects. And this is one of those great sort of unheralded resources out there for anybody who's involved in technology development, whether you're government acquisition or military, or just in the commercial world looking to deliver meaningful capabilities faster, better, and cheaper. And one of the rules they talk about is in order to do it quickly and do it right, you must first be willing to do it wrong. And so the idea is to do these small, constrained experiments, these quick and dirty prototypes. Most of them will fail, but those failures will become stepping stones to your eventual success. It's very similar to the venture capital approach where, you know, we invest in 20 different things, a small number of them pay off, and an even smaller number of them pay off huge. And so that's what one of the things the faster, better, cheaper model proposes.
The second one that you list is reject good ideas, and I see a counterintuitive theme developing here.
Absolutely, and you know the whole approach really was there's a lot of counterintuitiveness in it, and so the idea of rejecting good ideas comes from the Near Earth Asteroid Rendezvous project that I mentioned earlier, and the program manager said one of the things he did was that he said no to a lot of good ideas, and I like a lot of so much about that sentence because he's valuing these ideas, saying, hey, that is a good idea. I'm not saying it's bad. It's a good idea. We're just not going to do it because it's a distraction from our core mission. It's not essential. And so, again, it's sort of that idea of expressing restraint. The program manager for NEAR said if he had incorporated even half of those good ideas, he never would have actually built the spacecraft. So they only included the good ideas that could be made with negligible or minimal effort and disruptions.
The third is to simplify and accelerate everything.
You know, that's really key. And when we talk about the FIRE approach or the faster, better, cheaper approach, and there's a lot of overlap there, when we talk about focusing on speed, thrift, and simplicity, we can't limit that just to the technical designs. We can't limit it just to our organizational approaches or our processes and procedures. You really want to apply these concepts across the whole spectrum of decision making. So whenever you come up against an opportunity to take either the faster road or the slower road, the simpler approach or the more complicated approach, we want to move in the direction of speed, thrift, and simplicity across the board.
The fourth one is to limit innovation. And we talked about innovation at the beginning of our conversation. It's right in the title of your book, a subtitle of Igniting Innovation. So why do we want to limit it here?
You know, it turns out one of the best ways to get a lot of innovation is to not have too much of it. And again, it gets back to that idea of exercising restraint. So if we only include those technological innovations, those technological developments that are really essential to our key objectives, then that helps us actually achieve those key objectives. But when we do innovation for innovation's sake, when we absorb and adopt too many innovative ideas, and this really gets back to that FIRE prime directive, then we're going to end up with something that's over-engineered, which will cost more, take longer, and ultimately end up doing less than originally envisioned.
The fifth one is failure is an option. And Dan, this is something that people in government talk a lot about, wanting to have the option of being able to do and not feeling like, especially given the budget climate we're in right now, that they do have an option to fail. Why is this so important?
Yeah, you know, of all the five, this one might be my favorite. It might be the most important. Not a big fan of that sort of faux macho approach that says failure is not an option. You know, failure is always an option. There's always the possibility of failure. And that's one of the things that I mentioned earlier. Dan Golden said from the start, if we get 100% success rate, then we haven't been trying hard enough. So the idea of failure being an option means we need to be open to the possibility that we aimed for something, we tried to do it, and it didn't work out. But that then becomes a learning opportunity and a stepping stone for the future. And one of the nice things about the failure approach, or the FIRE approach, is that it makes failure more tolerable. When we have a short timeline, when we have a small budget, we haven't invested a lot of time and money, our exposure to loss is minimized. And you know, it's a little easier to fail on a two-month project, a four-month project, where you're spending a small amount of money, as opposed to failing on a decades-long, you know, billion-dollar project. Those failures hurt a lot.
There are examples in your book of failures and successes, and I would love to go through those. We just don't have the time. I do want to get to the reality, though, of how the FIRE techniques work in the world. The concepts that you lay out in the book make a lot of sense, and you document why you believe they are applicable and effective. How do we apply those folks who are working in government today, both civilian and defense agencies, using the tools that you have and using those not as obstacles to get around, but as tools that can help you. And I'm talking about things like the FAR, some of the other contract regulations, administration policies, and I'm not referring just to this administration. Every administration has its acquisition and procurement policies that it puts into place. How do you use those as tools to your advantage in trying to apply the fast, inexpensive, restrained, elegant philosophy to make things happen?
Yeah, you know, I think in large part it starts by reading the FAR and the Federal Acquisition Regulation. Boy, when I flip through that, I can find a lot to really hang my hat on, where it's directing us to focus on things like speed, thrift, and simplicity. And so when the FAR says to exercise restraint, I can point to that and say, hey, FAR paragraph 18.003 point, you know, subpart, whatever. I can say, this is the guidance that I'm being consistent with. And a lot of times the people who say, oh, well, you have to do it this way because that's what the FAR says. If you push back a little bit and say, show me the paragraph in the FAR that says that, that argument oftentimes crumbles. And the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy just put out a really great paper on the innovative contracting case studies. And they go through a number of ways that federal agencies can get more innovation per tax dollar. My FIRE approach is one of the case studies in that paper, but there's I think five or six others. And again, very specific, very concrete contractual vehicles and contractual authorities that we can use to reduce the cost, the schedule, and the complexity of this type of work.
We have a link to those case studies at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth in addition to information about this book. What's it like when you find out that OSTP and OMB are going to recognize your work and include it in an area that, I mean, they've really indicated by the amount of work that they've done in this area that this is a very high priority for the administration?
Oh, you know, it's so exciting to get that kind of stamp of approval for something that I've been working on for the past 10 years. It's really nice to be included in a list of things that I think the way the announcement put it, something along the lines of that these efforts are aligned with President Obama's management agenda, that this is consistent with the type of things that he's looking for government to do. Boy, it's really an honor to be included in that company.
Why is this your thing, Dan? Everybody has a thing. Why is this yours?
You know, about 10 years ago, I sort of sat down and said, you know, had those that deep thoughts about my chosen career and said, how do I do this well? How does the government do this well when this innovation thing? And I kind of noticed this pattern of the expensive, complicated, slow, unsuccessful approaches versus the fast, inexpensive, simple, and restrained approach that seems to perform well. And the more I read about it, the more I studied it, the more I experimented with it, the more I found that this FIRE approach really correlates really strongly within my innovation, I'm sorry, in my research as well as in my experience with the most impactful, most important, most successful projects. And I've always done the most when I had the least and done the least when I had the most. So I said, gosh, if this pattern works for me, I talked around with some other people, seemed to work in other places as well. And so I just do my best to help tell these stories as well and as widely as I can, just to sort of show what right can look like and to show that it can be done.
Well, congratulations on the recognition. Congratulations on the book. And I appreciate your time to talk about your work today.
Hey, thanks so much. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.